You tend to think that you know places that have the same language as you. And for me as a Brit, having lived in Australia, having lived in New Zealand, and having spent time in America, it's really important to maintain the same curiosity about those places as we would about a Spanish or French speaking nation. Because just because people speak the same language, there's probably a bit more like cultural diffusion, but America, and actually every single state in America and every single town, is really different.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today, my guest is travel journalist and TV presenter Ash Bardwaj, whose new book is called Why We Travel. I actually contributed to a chapter of this book in the context of the writing classes I teach in Paris each summer and how the city itself is a more effective teacher than any one mentor in the city. We talk about that in this episode, as well as the other themes of Ash's book, Why We Travel, including chapters about inspiration, happiness, serendipity, hardship, service, empathy, healing, wonder, eroticism, and hope. We start by talking about the first chapter of Ash's book, which focuses on curiosity. Let's listen in. So let's talk about curiosity as a motivation for travel.
Yeah, and I think right up front, it's important to say that there's not a hierarchy of motivations, right? I think we all travel for different reasons at different times. And the one that most people think about, when we talk about travel, we tend to think about destination first, right? Oh, I want to go to Thailand. I want to go to Kenya. I want to go to California. And then we think about what are we going to do when we go there? What kind of places we're going to stay? And then we think about who we're going to meet, who we're going to spend time with. That's the kind of way most of people talk about travel. But what I've tried to do when I was reflecting on it, because it wasn't until 2022 that I started to realize this, is sort of flip it on its head and realize if you understand the motivation first, then you can build out a trip from there. And so curiosity is the desire to like figure something out. And for me, when I am planning some of my trips now, it's because I want to answer big questions like, why do they speak Spanish in Colombia? Or why is the Union Jack on the flag of this Pacific island? Or why is the Queen the head of state of this Caribbean island? You know, why these are sort of things that are quite big questions. So those are questions of some importance. And then you've got questions of no importance. Those are the sort of things that you notice that make you feel elsewhere from home. Like, you know, for you, if you're traveling to Canada, you'd be like, oh, their accent's quite different. I wonder why that is. And you don't necessarily need to know the full root of the origins of the accents that people have, but it just makes you feel elsewhere. You're like, oh, I'm somewhere different. And I think both of those things really build the grist of what makes travel so fulfilling. You're finding something new about a place, and that's exciting. It's deeply rooted. I reference a guy called Professor Loewenstein. He talks about curiosity being a very innate human characteristic, part of what defines us as different from other primates. And therefore, I think, you know, when we're traveling with curiosity to answer these questions, we find it very fulfilling.
Yeah, you use the term destination, which is sort of a funny way to describe a place, right? A destination is almost like a marketing term. You know, it's like the consumer option of place. And so I think oftentimes in travel writing, we write about destinations because we're writing, you know, we're helping people plan their vacations and pay for things. But it feels like curiosity should peel back what is behind a destination and the bullet list things that bring us there. And it can really tie it to anything, including maybe rugby or other motivations for going.
Yeah, and I guess destination, yeah, you're right. It's an interesting use of the term. And I guess maybe in my mind, it started to mean more than a physical place. Like it's like a culture, but it's also where you go in yourself when you travel, right? It's a destination for, you know, travel Rolf or travel Ash. That's kind of like a place that you reach when you go somewhere inside yourself. So I think maybe there's an element of that too. But you're right, you know, when you go somewhere and explore these things, you realize that everything you encounter, the culture, the food, the drink, is a product of the accent, the language. It's a product of history. It's a product of geography. It's a product of landscape. It's a product of weather. And all these things interact with each other to create the experience you encounter. And you'll have a different experience to me because you're a different person to me. You look different, you sound different, you come from a different country, and that changes the way people respond to you, right? So everybody has a different experience when they get somewhere, which affects our subjective experience of travel.
Let's talk about your second chapter, which is inspiration.
I think part of this ties in with that term and debate that people have, like, what's the difference between a traveler and a tourist? And people get very het up about this. I've looked at some academics who talk about the way you distinguish different types of travel and try and formulate it as academic terms. And an explorer is a first person from a place to visit another place and bring back knowledge that the society they come from didn't know beforehand, whether that's cultural knowledge, geographical knowledge, or knowledge about a place more generally. Then a traveler will be inspired by the explorer. So they'll have heard stories from that explorer, and they'll go to that place and find things building on the knowledge of the explorer. So they're doing discovery of their own, but from the stories of the other person. And then a tourist is inspired by the travelers. They're often a bit more, conservative is the wrong, it doesn't summarize what this means, but they're people that need to know that things are okay to go somewhere. Like, you know, it's fairly safe. They know what they're going to get. And they're often replicating the experiences of the people before them. But of course, what we were talking about a few moments ago, no two people in sequence over time are going to have the same experience. So everything's always evolving. So really, everyone's reiterating or recreating travel every generation or every new trip. And early humans only traveled for three reasons: migration, to find new land, new resources, conflict and exploitation, and trade. Then later you started to get pilgrimage as another reason. And what we think of as traveling tourism, really, is brand new. It's like 150 years old. You know, the Grand Tour around Europe, then Thomas Cook and so on, and the hippie trail, and then going on to backpackers. So we are all inspired by the stories of the people that come before us. And, you know, like your book, Vagabonding, that has inspired a whole new generation of people to go out and try and not just replicate the places you went, because it's impossible to replicate the experiences you had when you wrote that book, but to get that same sense of discovery and of discovering themselves, which is something I talk more about in Eroticism and Wonder, but exploring the unexplored parts of themselves. So inspired by what you gain through travel, they go ahead and do it themselves.
It's interesting that you mention migration, conflict, and trade, because when we talk as travelers, I think sometimes we forget that the water we swim in is that sort of tourism world. You know, that I think it's interesting that you have experience as a soldier, and we forget that that's a much more ancient way of traveling than tourism-related travel. And then there's migration. And then I think sometimes we forget that there's so many displaced people in the world. So there's voluntary and involuntary migration. And we often don't think of them as travelers either. And then trade, you know, people who are merchants. And so I think it's really interesting to widen the scope of what travel is, to go beyond, because I think we have that argument, oh, are you a traveler or a tourist? Well, I mean, there's different iterations, but we're all sort of in that tourist category. You know, we're pleasure travelers, you know, so we're not here to fight a war or to trade goods or other things like that. We're not displaced. So that's an interesting distinction to make.
Yeah, and it's something that a woman called Dr. Daisy Fan writes about, who, I actually talk about it in the third chapter, but she looks at the type of traveler that you are based on how dependent you are on outsiders to facilitate your travel. So at one end, you've got the belonging seeker. This is somebody that goes usually on their own, lives somewhere for, you know, 6 months to 2 years, learns a language, works there, maybe doesn't have any friends from their home nation. Nearly everyone is their friend from that place. They become a local, fully immerse themselves, and they value the people there not as a means to an end, but as an end in itself. Now, contrast that with what she calls a dependent, the only reason a dependent traveler would encounter anybody is for what they can get out of them to make their travel experience better. They're short term. The most dependent is you're basically staying in a resort and all you do is you turn up and you don't really care about the place. It's almost like a copy-paste version of a resort in different places around the world. You wouldn't know whether you're in Spain, Jamaica, or Costa Rica. And then in between, you've got a few other versions, right? Like people who do a mix of it. People who are conservative, as in they might go on sightseeing tours outside of a resort, and others who will maybe find some of their own places. But then the person in between that most of us like to think that we are is that we're going there and getting to know people and engaging in a place, but we might not be learning the language and so on. But the way most people use the term traveler is usually a backpacker that is traveling for a long time. But it's really easy to be a traveler. You know, this is where the term the banana pancake trail comes from. And just trying to replicate the most comfortable bits of home. You can spend 6-9 months in Southeast Asia, Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, Thailand, and only speak to Americans, Israelis, Swedes, Australians, French, Argentinians. You don't necessarily learn anything about the people in the place that you're in, apart from them serving you in hostels or restaurants or taking you to waterfalls. And it's not about the amount of time that you're spending or how little amount of money you're spending. It's about your engagement with the local place.
Yeah, I read a tourism researcher, this has been 20 years ago, and she went in and she interviewed backpackers. And I come out of backpacking culture. Backpackers are very close to my heart. But the rhetoric of, oh, I spent a lot of time with the locals. She actually asked the follow-up question. It's like, well, when and how much and who? And she realized that rhetorically, backpackers, they say they spend time with locals because it is a status, you know, it's more of a status-driven thing. But she found out that most of the subjects she interviewed, she's an anthropologist, they spend it in contact zones. You know, these were the local people that they talked to were serving them drinks or cleaning their rooms or things like that. And so I think that's sort of an easier said than done thing, meeting local people, is that sometimes we really want to meet local people, but we're so comfortable in our little bubble, even on the backpacker trail. And I don't want to knock backpackers because that's my very roots, but it's even there, it's hard to get out of that bubble and to really engage in local communities.
Yeah, and the other thing that's important to say is, even if you are just doing that backpacking where you're just hanging out with other backpackers, there's nothing wrong with that. That's absolutely fine, you know, and it's a really good development of different types of travel, you know. And if you want to go to a resort and all you think about is what you're having for dinner and what time of day you start drinking beer, that's also fine, because that might be what you need at that time. You might need some psychological healing and just a break from the stress of life, and you might just want to have a bit of hedonism. That's absolutely fine. And it's just having that sort of self-confidence and self-reflection and honesty of going, actually, where am I on the dependency scale right now for what I want? And where is my motivation? And you can change up and down that dependency scale on the trip. So when I went to New Zealand that first time, I was completely dependent. I was part of a school rugby tour. And then I did go back and live and get to know and have local Kiwi friends. I mean, the main language in New Zealand is English, so it didn't take me long to learn the language. They do have some funny pronunciations, but that's about it. And, you know, so that was more of a belonging seeker of a sort. So you can go up and down at different times in your life in the same location, even on the same trip.
Well, we've been sort of talking about chapter 3 without introducing it for a while, because we're really talking about happiness. And in chapter 3, you mentioned the two Greek kinds of happiness, and you've already mentioned one of them. So let's fold that into the conversation, the different kinds of happiness and how that affects us as travelers.
So the Greeks had this concept that there were two things that you needed in life to be happy. We might use the word content. Now that might be the way we would understand it better. The two forms are hedonism, which is the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain. And the other one is eudaimonia, which is sort of self-development and pursuit of maybe purpose. And, you know, this was discussed by various Greek philosophers. And if you think about it, that kind of reflects on what most of us think that we need to be content. And that reflects on holiday. So hedonism is the form of tourism or travel that we probably do most of the time, or what we think about going on a beach, or well, maybe not all of us, but that is marketed to us, right? And therefore it dominates our thoughts. Going to Southeast Asia, lying on beaches, drinking cocktails, going to a full moon party, going to a beach in Ibiza and then going to the nightclubs and raving all day, going to Tuscany and drinking wine, or going to Napa Valley and drinking wine. And these are the sorts of things that are sold to us. Luxury hotels, comfort, lying, pursuit of pleasure, avoidance of pain. But eudaimonia has a part as well. So that, think about a ski holiday. You're going there, you're learning how to ski, you're challenging yourself. And, you know, if you've ever skied, you know, it's not always pleasant. And there's that element. And a part of the sort of cultural discovery fits into there as well. So it's kind of like activities and cultural stuff, maybe going to visit an art gallery, maybe learning about the local culture, visiting in New Zealand, like, I don't know, like an indigenous cultural centre. So it's those mix of things that sort of pitch to us really in tourism most often.
Yeah, and it's interesting to find a balance. Again, that destinations usually advertise hedonistic pursuits because we travel for leisure and for pleasure. I wanted to fold in chapter 4, which is mentors. What do you mean by that? Yeah. And is this in-person or hypothetical mentors?
I think it's both. So, for example, you have been a mentor to me before I even got to know you, in the abstract, through reading your work, through listening to your podcast. So you've taught me things, and there's always been, if not a direct dialogue in person like there is now, a sort of psychological dialogue. I'm like thinking about the concepts you talk about, whether that's about writing or engaging in a place. So you can kind of have these conceptual mentors who teach you about things. For me, the one that made a big difference was Ernest Hemingway. And he went to Paris in the 1920s and started to do lots of, I guess it was some of the first real travel journalism that was read about in the US and Canada, about what Europe was like and the things that were going on and the things you could experience there, whilst he was also writing his novels. And he wrote a book called A Movable Feast, which was about his time in Paris, but it featured a lot about his writing. So I first read that book to get an insight into Hemingway's travel journalism and the way he developed writing, because he's a renowned writer, of course. And I realized I didn't actually like him as a person through the personality that comes through in that book, but I learned a lot from it. And his writing is amazing. There's a reason he's so lauded as a writer. And I went to Paris and followed in his footsteps. And in doing so, the place itself became something of a mentor to me because of this history. So you've got another type of mentorship. And I know, you know, you spend lots of time in Paris and, you know, how do you find it as a sort of conceptual mentor as a place? Or is it's not even that the place is the mentor, but how do you find it?
Well, it's funny that you actually quoted me in this chapter, and I teach writing classes in Paris, and in a way, I feel like I'm cheating because Paris itself has so much to teach that you can send students out into the city to be a flaneur or to do a psychogeographical experiment. And the city itself just has so much, not just literary people. As an American, there's so many Americans who've been there and found inspiration, but French artists and pan-European creatives and now international creatives are there. And so I think that's an interesting point, to let the place itself be a mentor, and that sometimes you can show up in a place and not realize how it's going to mentor you yet. You know, you could, there's a guy named Georges Perec. I haven't taught him. I didn't teach him until last year. And he wrote an essay called, what's it called? I forget what the name of the essay is, but basically he just sits in a cafe and writes down everything that happens. Instead of traveling through the city, he lets the city just travel around him for a while. And it's wonderful. I didn't realize that after 20 years of going to this city, that this new Frenchman would sort of teach me another way of looking at the city, which I was able to pass along to my students.
I mean, I'm paraphrasing what you told me for this chapter, but it's the communities that you can create when you travel, and that Zen beginner's mindset of the mindset you can create and develop when you're in a place that going away allows you to do. I mean, you know, there's a reason so many of these writers went to France in the 1920s. You know, it felt exotic. It was cheap for them because of the exchange rate from the US dollar. But also they were away from home. And they were away from the mindset and culture that they were surrounded by, and they could therefore take a beginner's mindset and learn something new. And, you know, what your courses in Paris do so well replicates the reason why Hemingway loved it so much, which is that he was working with other writers, and there's that dynamic. So there's a difference between a coach and a mentor. A coach may not know something about the subject that they're coaching you on, or they may not be as good at it, but they help you discover it. Whereas a mentor gives you a bit of insight and advice. And for me, Hemingway was a mentor. You've been a mentor. I reference a Telegraph editor called Michael Kerr, who taught me how to develop pitches and ideas for different publications. And then the city of Paris itself was through its stories and the mindset I took into it.
Well, this flows right into the next chapter, which is serendipity. And I think that beginner's mind, it's sort of, you, when you travel, you're like a child again. You know, you as Bill Bryson said, you're not even really sure how to cross the street, right? Well, kids don't,
yeah, so
kids don't, they don't go through life with to-do lists. You know, they just go outside and run around. And I think that's a great way to find serendipity. And I think you mentioned something to the effect that we create bucket lists for ourselves as travelers, but that's sort of creating work. You know, we're replicating this sort of industrial productive life that we're supposedly leaving back home. So let's talk a little bit about serendipity and how to find our way into serendipity.
So serendipity is the accidental discovery of something, and then you can then apply a greater sense of meaning to it if you want to. And for me, I've had remarkable encounters where I've just noticed something and then taken action on it because I've had the time to do it. And I walked 1,000 kilometers of the River Nile with my friend Leveson Wood. He's doing a project called Walking the Nile. So he walked 4,500 kilometers from Rwanda to Egypt, from Rwanda, Central Africa to the Mediterranean, all the way the length of the River Nile. And I walked about 6,500 kilometers he did. I walked about a sixth of it through Uganda and Sudan. And so, you know, we were walking up to 50 kilometers a day. We didn't have phone signal or anything, so we'd either just be chatting to each other or just noticing the world around us. And, you know, I noticed things like when I was in Uganda, I noticed that most of the young men in village after village were wearing the shirt of a football team called Arsenal. Arsenal's a North London football team. And in 2014, when we were doing it, they weren't particularly good. They hadn't won anything for about 10, 11, 12 years. But 50% of the shirts I saw were Arsenal. I was like, why? Well, why are you wearing Arsenal shirts? Like, I don't know what the analogy is for any of the American football teams at the moment. But this made me notice something different. So I just started to get my camera out and photograph these people because my best mate back home is a huge Arsenal fan. So I only happened to notice it because I knew my mate would be interested. I took all these photos of these lads in their Arsenal shirts and, you know, they're really excited about it. And I'm like, yeah, take a photo of me in this one and this one in the away shirt. And then I got chatting to them. And I learned that the reason they supported Arsenal is, you know, 13 years beforehand, when the Premier League, the English Football League, went international, they were the best team. And they played a style of football that was exciting and fun. And they also had a lot of players of African origin in their team. A lot of guys from West Africa, a lot of guys from, you know, British Caribbean. And so these young black guys in Uganda saw themselves in this team. And then that carried on. And then that gave me a reason to start chatting to them and learn more about their life. So it was only because I had the time to do that that I was able to ask this question and learn about it and then discover what life is like in northern Uganda, you know, learning about the legacy of Joseph Kony, the Lord's Resistance Army, who used to kidnap kids in the village and raid villages, and the challenges of being a different ethnicity to people from the south and what that meant for job opportunities and poaching and things like that. And it was only because we had that time and that space and I could notice it. Whereas normally when we go on holiday, you know, it's precious time. It's time away from work. It's expensive. It's a lot of admin. It's a lot of hassle. So we want to pack in as much as we can into it. So, you know, we look on Instagram or we look on blogs about all the different things you should be doing in Barcelona or Paris. And yeah, it just becomes like work. You're just trying to tick off these lists. And I don't know about you, but the moments I remember from my travel are those accidental moments, like that time in Uganda, or when Lev and I ended up at this massive Sufi festival in the desert in Sudan because somebody told us about it in a cafe. these life-changing moments, those are what stick in my mind. It's not the cafe. It's not often, it's not the galleries. It's not the Michelin star restaurant or the top five bars of Instagram in Barcelona. It's a human interaction that's told me about something that has given me an insight into life.
Yeah, I love those surprises. I'm a Kansas City Royals fan, but you always see New York Yankees hats when you go overseas because they're the Coca-Cola of teams. Like everybody knows the New York Yankees. You go to Africa, Southeast Asia, people are wearing Yankee hats. The one place I saw a Royals hat was the Dominican Republic. I think for the similar reason, there's a lot of Dominican players who were on the Royals during that era. And so of course the Dominicans would relate to a team that other nationalities might not be because they had a personal connection to that. But yeah, I'm totally with you on the idea of time, that really giving yourself time allows you to have serendipity. You can't really plan for serendipity, but you can give your travel space, I guess, for serendipity to step in and happen, I think.
Yeah, you can set the conditions for it. You can't make it happen, but you can make it more likely.
Yeah. Well, chapter six is hardship. And I think maybe... some serendipity can come out of hardship, but you talk about type one and type two fun. Talk about that a little bit. What's the difference between type one and type two fun?
I mean, anyone who does like mountain climbing or marathons will have known these terms. So type one fun is fun at the time, fun in memory. That's, you know, going dancing, drinking a beer with your mates. Type two fun is rubbish at the time, but afterwards you're like, I'm really glad I did that. Hiking up a mountain, doing a marathon. Whilst you're doing it, it's often pretty miserable. And then afterwards, it feels good. In the book, I thought I'd come up with the idea of type three and type four fun, but as I looked into the research, there were other people as well. And type three fun is something that is just bad. It's bad at the time and it's bad in memory. These are things that you don't gain anything from. So type two fun, you do gain something from. You might develop resilience. You might develop an appreciation for a new thing. You might get fit. You know, things like going to the gym, you're literally damaging your muscles, but afterwards they're stronger for it. Type three fun, you're just damaging your muscles. There's nothing right. different. Or you're damaging your mind or your life. And then type four fun is this weird state that we get into that you'll have heard called flow states. And it comes from a concept from a Czechoslovakian?
Or Hungarian.
Hungarian. Sorry.
Don't ask me to pronounce his name, though. His name is like 20 consonants.
I have once nailed it to be able to get it right. It's Chernitzvaya. Mikhaili. Maybe we'll just edit that out.
Rolf. I quote him in my book, The Vagabond's Way, and I did an audiobook version of that. And it was so at one point I actually pronounced it correctly, but I would not commit it to memory. And as a person who we both have my first name and your last name are both a little bit unusual. So I can appreciate people wanting to pronounce things correctly, but I'm sorry to this Hungarian researcher who popularized the idea of flow. But in lieu of pronouncing his name, let's talk about his concept.
Yeah. He came up with this idea called the flow state, and he interviewed loads of servers, chefs, people of all walks of life, farmers, who found that they got to a certain competence of hard work where it didn't feel like work. They weren't thinking about it. And you may have found this with writing. I certainly found it towards the end of some of my army training when I was really fit and able to do things. I found it in skiing. I found it in other areas of my life as well. But this is where your competence and the challenge start to cross, where you're competent enough to do the task. It's still challenging, but you don't want it to end. You might still suffer. Like, you could be running, and you know that your legs are hurting and your lungs are burning, but you're in this flow state, and that's type four fun. And so when we travel, sometimes we might want to go and do tough things. We might want to try and get into this flow state. We might want type two fun, or we might want to get into this this type four fun state. And it's this chapter is exploring that, which isn't what you normally think about when you go on holiday. You don't want to go and suffer.
Chapter seven is about service. And so I know that oftentimes there's a thing called voluntourism. You know, there's the idea of giving back as travelers. But let's dig into the nuances of how service can be a motivation for travel.
Yeah, and I'm just going to touch on that bit about voluntourism because it kind of touches into eudaimonia as well, where you feel that you're going somewhere to do something good, but you can actually have really awful negative consequences for it. And for the voluntourism, the examples are basically business orphanages. And these are almost like human zoos, where particularly in places like Cambodia or places like Kenya, those are the two that I'm really thinking of. It happens in Nepal as well, where people want to do something good. They want to help orphans. They want to help poor kids. And they heard about charities, particularly in the 80s and 90s, that were sending money to places where there were orphanages. But what has started to happen is people didn't just want to go and volunteer and give what they could do for 6 months. You know, so if you were an English as a foreign language teacher going somewhere and teaching there for 6 months, there are people who just wanted to go and get a sense of the volunteering and maybe teach English for 2 weeks, but not be a proper English teacher. So they turn up and do very damaging work for these kids who, you know, that's work that, you know, you could probably have a local English teacher to do, but there's now this new demand for tourists to pay to go and teach English for 2 weeks. And so what's been happening in some places is basically kids have been taken away from their families, often very, very poor families, who've then been given money, been told that the kids are going to be looked after, and they're effectively creating human zoos. So this kind of tourism, whilst well-intentioned, unless you're checking through like a really good NGO, and I reference a few in the book about different charities and organizations that will tell you if this charity is a good one, you can be doing more harm than good, and let alone all the really awful parts of, you know, child exploitation that we see in places like again Colombia and again Cambodia and Thailand. And so voluntourism can be bad.
Yeah, actually, I was in the South Pacific last summer, and I met some missionaries. And the missionaries, you know, it's sort of a religious version of these NGO volunteering type things. Missionaries make multi-year commitments. They learn the language. It feels like they're at least trying to do good work. He said that one of the things he hated the most was hosting church groups, because you have all these young people come for 2 weeks and they really want to feel like they've helped, but it's hard to really help somebody in 2 weeks. And a lot of the young people don't have skills to help people with. And so it was really stressful for this missionary, because there was sort of this thirst for people to cross it off their list, you know, to sort of do their act of good deed, when in fact there was far more harm they could do in 10 days to 2 weeks than good. So I don't want to poo-poo the idea of volunteerism, but I think it's easier said than done. And oftentimes volunteerism can be more about the selfie of doing good work than actually doing good work.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're going to do it, look at organizations like Child Safe International, who have a list of basically accredited NGOs, so they know that you're not doing exploitative or damaging work with them. But as you say, even for these charities, what they want is people with really good, useful skills going there to deliver it. And that's what service is when you travel. It's when you're doing work that maybe the destination that you're visiting doesn't have anyone who can do that. And in the book, I talk about somebody called David Knott, who's a general surgeon here in the UK, who has traveled to some of the most challenging places in the world, Syria, Gaza, in the midst of conflict, not just after conflict, Haiti, Sudan, Darfur. And he has delivered surgery in those places. So he's a surgeon in the UK in the NHS, a general surgeon. And he goes to those places and delivers surgery in these like low resource conflicts, because all the other doctors and surgeons have either fled or they've been killed, and he risks his life to do it in these places, to do some good. And it's because there's no one else to do it, and he just wants to do that. You know, for me, my service was being in the British Army Reserve. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm doing the same kind of good as David Knott did, but, you know, I've done a couple of deployments or part of the deterrence mission for NATO in Europe. You know, I was part of improving the security of NATO in Europe. I mean, I don't think me alone was the deterrence. And I think Russia was afraid of invading Europe or Northern Europe because of me. But, you know, like, you can be a small part in this, right? And whatever skill you have, you can help a place. You know, if you're a writer, maybe you could do the copywriting for a charity website. Or if you're a lawyer or a paralegal, you could go and help refugees learn about what their rights are in a certain place. If you're a logistician, if you're a truck driver, you can aid an NGO with the delivery of goods into a disaster area. But it's taking what you get paid for here and giving it somewhere else rather than doing a job that someone in that country should be getting paid to do.
Yeah. This feels like something that benefits, as with other things we've talked about, is time. You know, if you have time to invest in a place, you can find out what the needs are, if what the actual needs of the community are, as opposed to what you think they might need before you go there.
Yeah, and you know, there's really good organizations that do this. In Germany, I can't remember what it's called, but there's an organization where basically you go onto a website, type in what your professional skill is, and they will then partner you up with organizations around the world to take that skill into a place. So I was chatting to a guy at an event in Seville recently who is a hotel manager in Germany. Like, he manages hotel chains, he's an operations manager, helps get it up to standard and get everything working correctly and well. And he went to Uganda for 3 weeks to help three different lodges improve their operations and their standards. Mm. So that they could operate more effectively, bring in tourists who would pay more so that more money went into the local community. Now, that's a really unexpected part of service, right? Where he's doing his ops, hotel manager ops work in Uganda. But that's the kind of thing you can get, you can find.
You were talking about Zen mind, beginner's mind, and that ties into number 10, which is wonder, yeah. Which I just like the idea of wonder. And the idea of awe. So how do you define this as dovetailing with travel?
Yeah. So everybody listening to this will know awe. It's that moment where your sense of self dissolves. You feel small, slightly terrifying, but you feel like it's a sort of spiritual experience, is a term that people sometimes use when they're referring to it. But it's where you go beyond yourself because of something external happening. So the kind of places this occurs, it might be seeing a magnificent sunset. It might be getting to the top of a mountain. It might be having an incredible view over a valley. It might be dancing at a music festival with thousands of people. It might be a religious experience. It could be seeing a phenomenal work of art. So awe is that felt experience that you have. Wonder is the mindset, the cognitive approach that allows you to experience awe. And I reference a woman called Dr. Anahita Nizami, who's researched this quite a lot, about putting people into the state of wonder so that they can experience awe. Mm. And often when you've experienced awe, your worldview can shift entirely. And in that chapter, I referenced the overview effect, which is astronauts and taikonauts and cosmonauts who've been to space and looked down on the Earth, and it's changed their perspective. So the overview effect is where they lose their sense of nations and divisions, and they see the world as one and the fragility of the atmosphere, and they become almost missionaries about protecting the Earth afterwards and overcoming conflict and pollution. And it's that new experience that you have. But wonder is something that you learn, I think, through practice, but also encouragement. So I'm sure you know there are plenty of people who will travel, even if they've been people who've traveled on a backpacker trail, who sort of don't quite get into the mindset of wonder and stick to hedonism. So you can be in the same place, like two people next to each other, but one can go into the mindset of wonder of, I'm going to go look at this amazing waterfall. And the other will be like, I'm just going to sit here and drink a fishbowl of rum. Not that there's anything wrong with that, of course. Although I'd probably go for a beer. Once you've developed that and practiced it, you realize that it's not necessarily the place or the travel. It's the mindset. Because what you think of as an amazing beach or an amazing place. It's just someone else's home, and they see it every day. And I encountered this in Japan. I remember I was on this volcanic mountain looking up at night at the Milky Way, and in the daytime there were these amazing eruptions from these sulfur vents. I was like, wow, I'm so glad I've seen this. I had this sense of awe. And I thought, but the people who live here, do they experience awe every day, or is this just the mountain they walk past? And I remembered I grew up in a town that had the Queen living in it and this amazing castle called Windsor. And I was like, I never thought about the fact that people literally come from other countries to see this because it gives them a sense of awe. I was like, oh, right, so maybe I just need to change my mindset. And so I've started to try and bring that notion of wonder to home. And I think this is that feeling that people get where they say, I see home with a new light, in a new light. Because I have a new perspective. You see the world, your home, through the eyes of a visitor. And that can be amazing. And I think you appreciate home a lot more. And the other thing with that is slowing down and doing slow travel, because you see stuff at a slower rate and at a slower pace. You're not just dashing to get to the destination. You're see the travel itself puts you into that mindfulness, and it's all wonderful. And that leads on to the other thing that people talk about when they travel, which is finding themselves. And it's by being away from home on your own, you can explore the often neglected parts of yourself. And when you're at home, you're seeing your friends, you're seeing your partner, you're seeing your colleagues, you're following certain patterns of behavior. Like you're the funny person, or you're the serious person, or you get emotional when you respond to something because that's just how you've been raised and patterned in that environment. When you go somewhere completely different, you're responding to new stimuli, and you might discover that on your own you respond in different ways, and that's the often neglected parts of yourself that you can encounter.
I think it's interesting that oftentimes you have to get away from yourself to find yourself. You know, we talk about the idea of the sublime, feeling very small in the universe. I think at this technological moment where we're sort of encouraged to inflate our egos through social media or to think that our opinions are super important, sometimes the physical act of travel, I think, allows us to shrink that, you know, false ego and then find who we really are. You know, instead of performing a version of ourselves, we can just sort of quietly find parts of ourselves as we travel. And I think that is part of the wonder mindset. This sort of ties in point number 11, which is eroticism. I mean, there's eroticism. There's a certain aspect to eroticism that it's purely physical, but we live in an age too where eroticism can be entirely virtual as well. So how do you define eroticism and how it relates to travel in your book?
Yeah. Eroticism, it's not about sex tourism, but okay. I did learn the term from a psychotherapist that specializes in relationships and through the lens of sex, not purely, but that's something that she talks about, called Esther Perel. And she conceptualizes eroticism as the gap between self and other that allows for surprise and discovery, because you don't know everything about the other person. You allow each other to surprise each other, and that brings delight and joy. That's the erotic in Esther Perel's conception. And it kind of touches a little bit on that point we were just talking about traveling and discovering something brand new and discovering unexplored parts of yourself. Because the gap between you and the world you encounter, particularly if you're going somewhere culturally very different, it's other, so it's going to surprise you. It's going to be unexpected. And in doing so, you create a gap between your self-concept and this newly discovered part of yourself. So you get the surprise and eroticism. I think you also can get it with travel itself. If travel becomes too familiar, as it started to do for me when it became just work, like it was like a pattern that I fell into when I was going traveling. So I was losing the sense of surprise. It was work. I was going and I was doing interviews and I was visiting all the guest houses and I was writing notes and I was reading the newspapers. And I wasn't allowing serendipity and I wasn't allowing for discovery. And then I discovered my now wife, Andrea Bardwaj, well, she wasn't Bardwaj then, she was Thompson then, Dre. And Dre and I went traveling actually down the west coast of the US and then into Costa Rica. And she traveled in a different way to me. And it was that gap between me and her that allowed us to have surprise and delight. And how she showed me a new form of travel that helped me rediscover the joy in travel. And when you speak to people that travel in couples, they often talk about how frustrating it is because they have to do what the other person wants. And sometimes they'll say, well, we just end up both being miserable because neither of us does what we want to do. And we both just do something naff in the middle. The alternative, which I suggest in the book, is you each take it in days to plan a trip. So if you're traveling with a mate or with a partner, one of you plans everything on one day and both of you do it. And then you get to chance, your partner plans all of it on one day and both of you do it. Then you plan it on the next day and both of you do everything. And what this does is it forces you to get into that early form of travel again, where you don't know what you like. You know, do you like traveling on a bus? I don't know. Do I like traveling on a train? I don't know. Do I like eating chicken's feet? I don't know. But more and more, and particularly with the homogenization of places through globalization, it's very easy to avoid things and just go for what you know you like. But what this means is you both get to do everything you want to do, but you're both forced to do something you would never choose to do. And sometimes you can discover things that you like, but it's also important to discover things that you don't like every now and again. I discovered that I quite like lying on the beach, but only for a couple of hours because that's what Joe wanted to do.
Right. No, this is a good, almost a good experiment for travelers that just sort of doing, because sometimes maybe a traveling couple, their interests are already fairly aligned, but having just that slight difference in how they would plan a day, I think would make for really interesting days. One interesting thing that happened with my wife when we traveled in the South Pacific last summer is that the Vanuatu Air went out of business. And so we had to travel by industrial ferry from island to island. And so she spent her 45th birthday asleep on the deck of a passenger ferry. And she didn't have that sort of dirtbag backpacker phase that I had. I mean, she's done a lot of traveling in Europe, a lot of trekking, but she didn't have that sleep on the deck of the ferry phase of her life. And even though I think she was pretty miserable at the time, it was a pretty special moment for the two of us because the stars were very bright and we had no comforts at all. It's something we survived together. So I like the thought of that.
So there's a mix of type one and type two fun there, Rolf. You've got the type one fun of seeing the stars.
Which also,
of course, gives you some awe. Brilliant.
Yeah.
And then the type two fun of the fact that it was a bit miserable, but you can talk about it as a bonding moment now.
Yeah, absolutely. Another aspect of couples travel is the idea of taking time off from each other, not really giving each other permission to plan the itinerary from day to day, but actually having a day completely apart. I don't know if you do this very much, but I think sometimes it can be interesting to just sort of follow your own curiosity by yourself and then your partner does the same thing and then you meet and compare stories.
I think you can also do that sort of at home a little bit, right? You know, you can just go and take little overnight trips to go and see your mate that lives in a city a couple of cities down the road, or even just on a daytime, you know, on weekend. It's so easy, particularly if you've got kids, just smash everything in and be like, oh, we've got to co-parent the whole time. But, you know, it's nice to have a weekend day to yourself. I mean, usually you can manage your multiple kids on your own for a couple of hours. We've only got a 2-year-old, so it's definitely possible to manage her on our own for a few hours. But to give yourself mini breaks even at home, you know, there's a reason you live in the place that you live, but it's so easy to just kind of not allow for any serendipity or curiosity or joy in the place that you live.
Yeah, no, I'm a big fan of superimposing this onto one's home routines as well. In my last book, The Vagabond's Way, had a lot of parallels there because that was written during COVID when I wasn't really traveling. The last chapter is hope. I have in my notes that there is physically active travel, contemplative travel, and commemorative travel. What do you mean when you talk about those different kinds of travel?
So this was after my mom passed away from ovarian cancer. I was like my father, I wasn't really that bothered after he passed away. I was pretty broken when mum died. And being a travel journalist and traveler, I listened to people who said, oh, take a break, you know, go away and just, you know, relax and enjoy yourself and forget about everything. And I actually went on a holiday with Dre and some of her mates to Sri Lanka. beautiful villa, beautiful place, beautiful beaches, beautiful food. And I was absolutely miserable because all I could do was think about how much I missed my mum. She was the most amazing person. And she's the reason I travel. She did that second cleaning job and sent me to New Zealand and encouraged me to play rugby. And yeah, so I was just in Sri Lanka where everyone else was having this lovely holiday, Dre and her mates. And I was just miserable. And I was not good company. And it was hard because I knew that I was not good company. And I sort of wanted the outside world to reflect how I felt, but I didn't want to ruin things for everybody. So I just went home early. And then I learned about this concept of grief travel and these different forms of grief travel. There is just looking after yourself for a few days. There is going to do something, or actually going somewhere and being looked after by others, just so you can be in your grief for a while and just be left to be in your grief, but be looked after. There is doing something physically active. There is commemorative. There is intuitive. And then there's sort of informative, where you go away and learn things. What I realized is that in the 2 years between my mum's diagnosis and her death, she'd always been doing this herself. We did lots of trips together around the UK, and she was almost doing this grief travel for her own life. We did trips to go and visit family, to reflect on things that mattered to her. We went to go and learn new things, and we went places where she just, you know, was looked after and made cozy. More of those with my sister, actually. And so when she died, and I was thinking about this after Sri Lanka, and we had mum's ashes, I realised there was one place I wanted to go to combine many of these things, and that was New Zealand. Because mum and I had talked about travelling to New Zealand together many times, but cancer got in the way. So it was a way for me to travel to New Zealand with my mum. And did all those different things in this trip, went to places we talked about going together, visited family. It was a journalistic trip, so I learned loads of new things. And I thought about mum all the time and sort of spoke to her, you know, just as I bumbled along, oh, mum, there's this, you know, you would have loved to have seen this. And the other thing is we went with Lyra, who mum never met. So Lyra was born almost a year to the day after mum died. And her middle name is mum's first name. Hmm. And so it was very, very difficult, but very moving. Like I was crying a lot, very emotional the whole time. But it was a way to transform grief into hope, because it allowed me to look to the future with Lyra and remember that mum was always with us. And there was a particular moment, we ended up carving a stone in this place called Hokitika. Have you been to New Zealand, Rolf?
Yeah, I've been in the North and the South Islands, but I haven't spent a ton of time either time. I've been there for about a week or 10 days twice.
Ah, okay. Well, if you get the chance, I'd happily give you an itinerary of both islands that I love.
Awesome.
On the west coast, there's this place called Hokitika, and it's a place where this particular stone that's important to the Maori is often found, called Punamu or Ponamu or Punamu, depending on where you come from. That's how they translate it differently. But we actually carved a blue stone called Altia because Dre loved it, and it matched Lyra's eyes and it matched my mum's eyes. So I've got brown eyes, but Lyra's inherited the blue eyes from my mum. And so we carved this piece, and I went and caught up with a Maori friend of mine who I used to work with. And he said, you've got a name for your treasure, bro. I'm like, no, I haven't. Does it have to be a Maori name, Hemi? He goes, yeah, of course, bro. And I was like, well, I don't speak Maori, Hemi. Can you give me a Maori name for it? And I just told him the story of Lyra and mum and carving the stone. And he said, Kia whakatamuri te haere whakamua, which means I walk backwards into the future with my eyes fixed on the past, because your daughter will always have her grandma watching over her through the same eyes, and your treasure, your necklace, will remind you of that always. Hmm. And so I think about mum and her connection to Lyra every time I look at my necklace, which I never take off. And that was part of this transmuting of grief into hope. And it was the most powerful and significant journey I think I've ever done. Of course, I still miss mum every day, and I still have grief for her, but I can cope with it now.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about Ash Bardwaj's book, Why We Travel, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.